This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for February 2012. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings by a few of the poets in the issue.
This month on the podcast, we're going to hear from Jose Antonio Rodriguez.
All of them like halos, without saints to weigh them down.
Philip Metris.
The curdy vomit of God, the soiled swaddle of God.
Connie Voisin.
It's the uglier business, willing yourself from despair to belief.
And we're also going to speak with novelist Catherine Towler about poets and religion.
In addition to the poets we just mentioned, the February issue also includes poems by Dean Young, Vijay Seshadri, A. Stallings, and quite a few others.
Including Robert Frost, Robert Creeley, Langston Hughes, Liesl Mueller, Weldon Keyes, Rabindranath Tagore, Janet Lewis, and Eleanor Ross Taylor.
As part of our ongoing celebration of poetry's 100 years in existence, we're actually republishing a handful of poems that have appeared in the magazine.
We haven't called it the religion issue, but these poems and the new poems we're publishing, as well as the prose, are all preoccupied in various ways with spiritual questions.
Yeah, Don and I had in mind doing some sort of religion issue for a long time, but it never seemed to come to fruition. We couldn't find the right material, and this one actually came together sort of accidentally, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the truth is that we get so many poems that are about, perhaps not religious issues exactly, but about spiritual questions, that it's fairly easy for us to put together an issue loosely based around spiritual issues. It's so many poets are focusing on this right now.
Yeah, it's almost crazy to pretend that these things don't come up in poetry all the time. And I think by religious and spiritual questions, we want to mention too that not everybody is religious. The writers we're talking to raise questions about atheism or even agnosticism or confusion, as well as devoted faith.
It seems like most of them aren't religious. They seem to have objections to that word religion.
Right. It's something everyone struggles with. So it's not a pat thing where you're going to get sort of platitudes.
Yeah, one of the writers in the prose section, I believe it's Alicia Ostreicher, says that isn't it obvious now that we're living in a post-secular age? Can we all admit that? And I actually agree. I think that if it's true that poets are, in fact, the antennae of the race, then maybe they're picking up on this in advance, that this is a huge cultural shift. And us seeing all these poems on the issue is evidence of the first tide.
We'll see.
Yeah. There's a lot to choose from in this issue. It's a big issue. But, Dom, is there anything in particular you wanted to start with?
Well, we have an intriguing poem by Robert Pinsky, former poet laureate of the United States, and I think a lot of our readers are familiar with Robert Pinsky's work. This is an unusual poem, and it's called Creole, but it's not at all what you'd think from the title. The first lines go like this: I'm tired of the gods. I'm pious about the ancestors. Afloat in the wake widening behind me in time, the rest of divisors. That's a pretty arresting beginning, but I'll read the last couple of stanzas. It's in couplets, really, and I'll read the end of the poem. Optician comes from a Greek word that has to do with seeing. Banker comes from an Italian word for a bench where people sat, I imagine, and made loans or change. Pinsky, like Tex or Brooklyn, is a name nobody would have if they were still in that same place. Those names all signify someone who's been away from home a while. Schiavone means a Slav. Milford is a variant on the names of poets, Milton, Herbert, Sidney. Certain immigrants gave their offspring. Creole comes from a word meaning to breed or to create in a place. So that may be emblematic of some of the spiritual questions in the issue, the way spirituality has a history, a literal history, a lineage, that people come from different places and different traditions. And somehow in poetry, of all places, the language connecting us to those traditions gets mixed up and sort of churned around and repurposed or
you get
preserved.
The sense that, yeah, for Pinsky, the notion of transcendence isn't really too important. I'm tired of the gods, he says.
Yeah. You know,
he makes his poems, and one would guess he makes his sort of personal theology out of scraps of history and etymology and knowledge. It's a secular outlook.
And it's an American outlook, too, which I think Pinsky does explicitly. You know, he's written about democracy and he's written about our culture. This weaves together the kinds of strands that have woven together the nation's outlook. But I guess, you know, implicit in this, too, is just the real depth. I mean, how far back all these things go so that the names connect us not just with place, but with the people and traditions who make the place that we live in now.
Yeah. What I like about Pinsky's poems is that you can always get some bit of esoteric information out of them. You know, you always come away from someone. It's like reading a nonfiction book, you know. You always come away with something that you certainly didn't know, like the origin of these names that you were just reading. There's one that I liked quite a bit, a very different poem, a short little poem by a poet named Dean Nirksey, who's been in our pages several times. It's called Psalm to be Read with Closed Eyes. Ignorance will carry me through the last days, the blistering cities, over briny rivers swarming with jellyfish, as once my father carried me from the car up the tacked carpet to the white bed, and if I woke, I never knew it. And that's the whole poem.
Yeah, and you read it with open eyes, I noticed.
Exactly. Well, the title is a paradox. It sort of gets to the heart of the poem. You know, it's a psalm to be read with closed eyes, but of course you cannot read anything with closed eyes. And this poem, in a way, situates tactile experience in the midst of this ocean of mysteriousness.
Mm-hmm.
It describes a great paradox about how we were led on to revelation, hopefully, by our ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very poignant sense of the end of our experience. You know, the child is the father of the man, as Wordsworth said, but the end of our experience recapitulating the beginning of our experience. And so he remembers this event of being carried by his father.
Well, it's an ingenious poem because the ending of it, there's sort of a turn in the middle. As once my father, you know, there's a comma and it shifts gears. And the end of the poem talks about that thing where you're a kid and you're asleep and, you know, your parents sort of carry you somewhere and put you to bed. So this is a kind of knowledge that you have with closed eyes, the knowledge you have when you're asleep or innocent, especially a kid who's asleep and innocent has a kind of knowledge or is about to. But the first part of the poem says, ignorance will carry me through the last days, which is the ending of life, the way it's described in this poem, the blistering cities over briny rivers swarming with jellyfish. It's apocalyptic.
Yeah.
So it's not just the ending of an individual life with all the, you know, sort of innocence and experience, but it's the whole planet. And so the poem is constructed in such a way that it links these two with really just a comma, with that as. That's the kind of fulcrum that a poem can have, yoking these things together.
Philip Metris is a poet whose work is more often than not politically focused. His new chapbook is called, for example, Abu Ghraib Arias, and he has a special interest in what has become known as documentary poetry.
In what would seem to be a departure for him, one of his recent projects was to write a poem a day generated from a daily reading of the Bible.
In chapter 9 of Isaiah, there's a line, "For every boot that tramped in battle, every cloak rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for flames." And I was just sort of playing around with some of the images from that beautiful verse, then came to this sort of weird revelation about God as a baby, which I guess is the Christmas story in a way.
The poem is called Compline, and the Compline is the last of seven prayers of the canonical hours. It's the night prayer.
This poem, in a very direct way, is about being in the darkness. A literal darkness, the darkness of the season, and the sort of metaphorical darkness of the time of war that we found ourselves in for the last 10 years.
Here's Philip Metris reading Compline.
That we await a blessed hope, and that we will be struck with great fear, like a baby taken into the night. That every boot, every improvised explosive, talon and hornet, Molotov and rubber-coated bullet, every unexploded cluster bomblet, every Kevlar and suicide vest, an unpiloted drone raining fire on wedding parties will be burned as fuel in the dark season. That we will learn the awful hunger of God, the nerve-fraying cry of God, the curdy vomit of God, the soiled swaddle of God, the constant wakefulness of God, alongside the sweet scalp of God, the contented murmur of God, the limb-twitched dream-reaching of God. We're dizzy in every departure, limb lost. We cannot sleep in the wake of God, and God will not sleep the infant dream for long. We lift the blinds, look out into ink for light. My God, open the spine, binding our sight.
Those puns at the end ramify or in the poem, I guess. You know, we look out into ink for light. Well, you could say that the ink is the darkness that we look out into, and of course it is the ink of the poem. And then spine is obviously the spine of the body. We open that at the end of our lives, and that presumably in the Christian tradition is when we first see God. And of course, you open the spine of a book. Mm-hmm. So these two
Bible
things.
Bible or prayer book.
Right.
Well, it's a poem that avails itself of the astounding rhythms of prayer or biblical verse.
Yeah, in odd ways, right?
It brings in those, I was going to say, yeah, very odd ways, very up to date. I mean, you don't expect Kevlar and suicide vests and unpiloted drones raining fire in wedding parties to be in this, and yet that kind of violence really is in, for instance, the Old Testament. These struggles are real, have always been with us, and the question always is, in what way you learn what this poem calls, for instance, the awful hunger of God.
What it does so effectively, I think, is make you feel that radical notion of Christianity that God actually became human. And if we think of God becoming human, then he had curdy vomit, you know.
he had soiled swaddle.
Right, the soiled swaddle.
Because he was a baby, right?
Right, he had a shitty diaper and everything. That's what God had. And I mean, if you believe that God was human to that extent, then it follows that all of the other things that are human somehow contain God too, or somehow can manifest his presence or something. And that, I think, is the reason that we get these bizarre things, mm-hmm. Talon and Hornet, the Molotov and rubber-coated bullet, the cluster bomblet, that in some way divinity exists in these things as well. I'd be interested in hearing him answer that, but...
Well, yeah, I guess if you look at it relentlessly the way the poem does, if God has a human incarnation and he's in us, then when we invent and deploy these terrible things, where does the part of God that's in us go?
Yeah.
I like very much in the poem the noticing of the limb-twitched dream-reaching of God. I think that's very poignant. I mean, that humanizes everything a little in a way that's more mysterious than these other violent things, because you do have the violent attempt to be at peace, but your body twitches. And I like the idea that even God is reaching for a dream, or maybe that's what we are doing in all our wicked and misguided behavior on earth.
Well, there's some unknowingness there, right? I mean, the limb twitch, dream reaching, it suggests that you're suffering a dream, you know, that in some ways. And how can God suffer in the way that we do, you know, suffer a fearful dream or suffer unknowingness?
Yeah.
That seems to be the mystery of Christianity.
Yeah.
This is the first appearance of Jose Antonio Rodriguez in poetry. And he was born in Mexico, raised in South Texas, and spent a few years in New York, where he says he's done the bulk of his writing so far.
His poem in the February issue is called Sunflowers, and as an epigraph, there's a quote from Alan Shapiro's poem, Ah, Sunflower.
Which in turn is a response to William Blake's poem, Ah, Sunflower. So the sunflowers of Rodriguez's poem come to us with their literary provenance clearly marked.
I was sort of fascinated by the idea of the speaker versus the subject they're speaking about, and I figured I'd join the conversation.
Here's Jose Antonio Rodriguez reading Sunflowers.
No pitying awe for this one, Alan Shapiro. No, nor a fierce hurrah for what it does without choice, for following the light, for the same reason the light follows it. Just a thing rough to the touch, a face like a thousand ticks turning their backs, suckling at something you can't see, and a body like a tag off the earth, so that my child's hands couldn't tear it out from the overgrown lot next door. My palms raw with a shock of quills and spines, its hold like spite and ugly, except when seen from a distance, a whole field of them by the highway, an 80-mile-per-hour view like a camera's flash, all of them like halos, without saints to weigh them down.
I love that last line.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Without saints to weigh them down.
Poets are always looking for that line that just squares away things and leaves them in the reader's lap. And that's a brilliant and powerful ending of the poem.
Yeah.
What would those halos be like without the saints to weigh them down?
Yeah, saints for all their perfection still weigh down the halo. Still pretty nasty creatures.
But it's also a lovely image of the sunflowers with their drooping heads. Maybe the flower part is the halo. And the sunflowers do get weighed down somehow by their bodies at some point in the season. Strange images in the poem.
Just a thing, rough to the touch. A face, like a thousand ticks turning their backs.
You know, I grew up all around sunflowers, but I would never, that wouldn't have occurred to me.
Right. Suckling at something you can't see, and a body like a tag off the earth.
A little scary.
Yeah.
It's not a peaceful kind of imagery.
So that my child hands couldn't tear it out from the overgrown lot next door. My palms raw with a shock of quills and spines.
You know, they're ugly up close. It's whole like spite and ugly except when seen from a distance.
Well, one thing about the sunflowers is, as everybody knows, they follow the light, which, again, sounds like a spiritual thing. But I guess in the poem, the way it's describing sunflowers is that when you get up close to them, they're sort of thorny and spiky and unpleasant to the touch.
But it reiterates the notion we were just talking about, that we think of God as being at a distance and remote and untouchable, and there being something very attractive about transcendence. But the Christian notion, at any rate, which I think this is in the tradition of, although I don't read it as a Christian poem especially, but once you get down close, there's the ugliness of humanity, that even the very best of humanity, the saints, supposedly, compromise the effect of the sunflower.
Well, I like how he says that it's whole like spite and ugly except when seen from a distance. That, too, raises the question of, does God see us from a distance? When he gets close to us, are we ugly to him?
Probably so.
Rip us up by the roots?
Probably so. Well, speaking of that, we can move to this other poem. You know, Connie Voisin is speaking about George Herbert, who talks about these issues a lot. And we had a poem by Connie Voisin in the magazine last summer. We read it on the podcast, and we've got another one, another poem by her in the February issue, and this time she's going to read it for us.
Connie Voisin normally lives in Las Cruces, where she directs the creative writing program at New Mexico State University, but this year she's a Fulbright Fellow in Belfast.
She travels a fair bit, and she told us that when she goes to non-English-speaking countries, she likes to bring along one book in English.
And I was traveling in Mexico, in Central America, and the only book I brought was George Herbert's The Temple. And the poems in that book became the narrative of my trip through Mexico.
Her poem is actually called The Altar by George Herbert, and it mixes travelogue with reflections on Herbert and the nature of faith.
Herbert himself was a very disappointed man in some ways. You know, at the time he had sort of had high hopes for his own career and ended up in a very small church in rural England with consumption. He died pretty young. So things didn't turn out the way he thought they would. And so a lot of these poems, I see them as negotiations where he's trying to talk himself into belief. And the work of doing that is for him faith itself.
Here's Connie Voisin reading The Altar by George Herbert.
Tulips panted against the wall. So much need to feed a crisp stem, I thought, as we put our fingers in the bullet holes above the bed. Typed captions translated photos of Rivera, Kahlo, Trotsky and his wife in her boxy suit, devoted smile, that hopeful hat with bent feather below an image of the assassin who would get her husband in the end. George Herbert was what I translated, The Temple, the only book I brought, where he says the heart must be a stone on which to build God's altar. No love without affliction. My hard heart meets in this frame. In those days, I loved the jungle, spread like wool below an unsteady sky and the crumbling pyramid's altar top flocked with moonlight. I loved the monkeys throwing sticks and rinds at tourists from their nests in the trees, the noise at night, the hysterical crush of insect limbs rubbing, animal want, all night banged against the window, each with an urgent song of me, 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 how loud the fecund world can be. Mi corazón duro, I wrote, bored, and smoke rose from other tables, from the wheels of the cars on the cobbled roads, and once I saw a mouse, suicidal, enter the frantic crowd. I cried out at the park in Mexico City, where Indians, ropes on their ankles, dove like fatal birds to the ground while a Hasid in his 19th century cloak kept after me. Speak English? English? He said, we've all become vegetarians. There isn't a butcher for miles. I watched his black hat disappear into the swarm of vendors, masked dancers. Was that it, devotion? Young and gorgeous for it, I crept away one night, met a German hippie, and he pulled my swimsuit aside in the volcanic lake. The fat Costa Rican's coffee plantation unfolded below, the ranging packs of filthy dogs, the water so hot and sulfured, I gleamed like something ephemeral. Sometimes I saw movies, cheap Hong Kong action films dubbed into Spanish with Mandarin subtitles. But that started to get difficult. The young men dying with extravagance, the improbable ballet of whizzing swords, gunfights, and tea houses filled with caged birds. Herbert, consumptive and small country parish bound, wrote that struggle must be the same as resolution, as faith itself, while he suffocated in his sad minister's bed for years, arguing with God and himself. It's the uglier business, willing yourself from despair to belief. In those days, I thought the saints, robes heavy with must, with ancient gnarled hands, deserved the nothing they felt their way toward. In those days, my favorite saints were the ones who burned away young. I admired them in the cathedral paintings, hooded eyes, the brutal wings of their ribs, gilt halos, Baroque frames. What does it mean, devotion? Mothers weep in the corners of those paintings, while a man each morning sweeps the church floor.
You know, it's interesting. I remember when this poem first came to us, and I was quite struck by the idea of reading George Herbert through a, you know, while you travel through Mexico. It's what Elizabeth Bishop used to do, by the way. That was the only book she carried with her when she traveled as well. I don't think of Herbert as wrestling with religion in quite that way. I think there's a temptation always to project our experience of belief backwards. And I think mostly Herbert didn't have a problem with the existence of God, but he wrestled with whether he was worthy of God, and he wondered why God wasn't there beside him and in his life, which is a different sort of argument. I agree with her that she says it's the uglier business. She's put her finger on it. It's the willing yourself from despair to belief. Because if you can't do it, you can't will yourself from despair to belief. There's no way to do that. And Herbert did certainly struggle with that. He did have a happy life in his last 3 years, though, because he was married and he hadn't been married. And he was very much, by all accounts, he was very much in love with this woman and she with him. And so it's nice to think of Herbert having that end, although his ambitions had been, as she says, as Connie says, defeated.
Well, he must have known, too, that part of the affliction, no love without affliction, the poem says, my hard heart meets in this frame. You know, he put his poems together in such a way that on his death they could be handed intact as a book, as a structure to people who would care for the work, and that's how we have it now.
He told his friend to keep them only if he thought that they would be of use to other people.
Right.
And of use, he meant, in their faith.
That's right. That, to me, is why it's interesting that Connie takes the book with her on a trip. I mean, that's in a way what the book was supposed to do. I mean, one of the strange and ingenious things about George Herbert is that he has constructed a temple that goes where you go. That wherever poetry or readers or people can go, they can bring that temple with them. You think of a temple as being a building, an artifice with a foundation,
That's
which
really
it does have, and yet it's entirely portable because it's actually a structure that is made of poetry.
Yeah, and the poem comes from the altar. I mean, the one that Connie Voisin mentions is actually shaped like an altar. Part of it reads, "A heart alone is such a stone as nothing but thy power doth cut. Wherefore each part of my hard heart meets in this frame to praise thy name. that if I chance to hold my peace, these stones to praise thee may not cease. O let thy blessed sacrifice be mine, and sanctify this altar to be thine. That's just exactly what you're saying, that he's talking here about the altar of the poem, but by extension about this altar that he's making out of all these books.
It's very peculiar, and that's why one of the pleasures of this poem, of Connie's poem, is that it's peculiar too, because when it talks about things like meeting a German hippie who pulls her swimsuit aside, as a reader, you think, how the heck does this connect with George Herbert?
And translating Herbert on the table. And she says she wrote it and she got immediately bored. Mi corazón duro, she says, and then she's bored. How do these things connect?
I can only guess that traveling, in her case, you know, to a place like Mexico, the altar there that she sees is a crumbling pyramid's altar top. So the juxtaposition of the sort of relics and leftovers and ruins and other surviving traditions as well of other people, of other faiths or transmutations, say of the Christian faith as you'd encounter them in Mexico, that juxtaposition or even paradox must have enlivened Herbert's poetry for her as it stands in English. It may not be exactly translatable, but it survives. And one of the juxtapositions here too is that you can't really imagine George Herbert in Mexico.
I mean, no.
Hanging out with the tourists on the Costa Rican coffee plantation or you know, watching cheap movies and, you know, dubbed into Spanish. You can't imagine these things. And yet poetry asks of us or requires of us that we do, that we have to reconcile so many separate, seemingly separate things. They somehow must fit together. And this poem struggles with putting all these things together somehow.
And Herbert is such a contained poet, and this poem is inclusive. It reaches out to bring in all kinds of different experiences. It's the opposite of George Herbert.
Yeah.
What does it mean, devotion? Mothers weep in the corners of those paintings, while a man each morning sweeps the church floor.
Is that an answer? I'm not sure if that's an answer, if it's just an image that we're left with. But if we take it as an answer, devotion means caretaking. It's a chore, right? It's a chore that you do with some sort of divine purpose. You do thinking of God. But mothers weep in the corners of those paintings. Presumably that sorrow is part of the devotion too.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a sad question because at some point it all ends and maybe you're just left with questions and images and a kind of loneliness.
Well, Herbert has the line, sorrow was all my soul. Mm-hmm. I scarce believe till grief did tell me roundly that I lived.
It's not alienated, but it is lonely.
It's very lonely. Yeah, Connie Voisin is very right about that, and she catches sort of the essence of Herbert.
Yeah, and in the most unexpected way.
For prose in the February issue, we have a section that we call One Whole Voice, and it's comprised of various poets from Fanny Howe, Grace Paley, to Kazim Ali, to Jane Hirschfield, and several others, all reflecting on the relationship between religion and poetry.
Our selections are extracts from the forthcoming book, A God in the House, Poets Talk About Faith. The book is edited by poet Ilya Kaminsky and novelist Catherine Towler.
The book was published by Tupelo Press, and it's coming out later this year. I should point out that I was one of the poets interviewed for the book, which is how it originally came to my attention. Catherine Towler joins us by phone from her home in New Hampshire. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You know, before we get into the selections themselves, I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit about your own religious background and maybe how that led to an interest in the religious preoccupations of poets.
I grew up in the Episcopal Church. My father is an Episcopal priest. So as a child, I went to an Episcopal Church school. I attended church 6 days a week. But I think in particular how it informed me is that I've always struggled with faith myself and always felt that I was a person of very ill-defined or wobbly faith. And I think my interest in having these conversations that led to this book came from a desire to understand how do other people do this, something that I always felt that though it had been a major piece of my life, I had never fully understood.
Hmm. You know, I was struck by some of the contrasts, and I just opened the magazine. I have it here in front of me, and on facing pages, we have Joy Harjo. And she says, I stay clear of membership in any organized religion. From my study of history, theology, and metaphysics, especially from the perspective of an indigenous person in this country, I understand that organized religion is responsible for dismantling and destroying indigenous cultures all over the Western Hemisphere. This is still happening within our tribal nations. Now, on the facing page, we have G.C. Waldrop, who, it turns out, is a conservative Anabaptist. And he says, for me, a serious commitment to faith, a living faith, within an Orthodox tradition such as conservative Anabaptism, meant that certain questions were settled, if not in my heart, then in the wider sense of how and what the world is. Moving within and among those settled questions, as a subjective human intelligence and a sensual being, is the freedom. I just found myself agreeing and disagreeing and getting worked up by the book. Did that happen to you? Did you, Don? Did that happen to you when you were reading these?
It had an effect of confusing me nicely. So what happened to me was I would sort of go along with what I was reading and say, yeah, that's well put. I agree with that. And then the next piece would come along and I would have to undo my certainty about what I'd thought from the previous ones.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I kept bouncing around. And my favorite piece, in a way, was from Grace Paley. The editors were lucky enough to talk to Grace Paley before she died. And she says, I think there is really a problem with the use of the word spirituality right now. It's too loose. People who don't want to talk about religion use this word. They want you to know that they are spiritual people, even though they are not religious, that they have souls, so to speak. I'm wary of that kind of conversation. I prefer for people to talk about the reality of what's happening and what they feel for one another, what men feel for women, women for men, how we feel about our children. Is this spiritual? Spiritual is just a word people use when they want to be part of some great, and this is in quotation marks, religious conversation.
I couldn't disagree more. But Abraham Joshua Heschel says that, you know, religion is he talks about these moments of transcendence that we have in our lives, and he says that religion is not made of these moments. And I think that's what she's referring to, these moments of family and these moments of intensity that we all have. He says religion is not made of these moments, but it's what you do with these moments, so what you do afterwards. And so, but we don't have any word for what these moments are.
Right. But her frustration sort of leapt out at me. And there was something I liked about it. And I guess a question I have for Catherine was, implicit in the work of putting this together, did you sometimes feel that kind of frustration or aggravation with just the jumble of problems that these conversations create?
I would agree with you to some extent that I might have found things that I wouldn't agree with in some of the conversations, some of the things that you have just pointed to. But I think that Grace Paley is right. I think the word spiritual is overused. And the passage that you cite from Joy Harjo, although maybe I don't agree with everything that she has said in that passage, she has a point about the church as an institution that is often way too interested with preserving its own survival as an institution. So I found things to agree with in every conversation we conducted.
Well, I guess to some extent, you know, each of these writers as a poet, they make their case in the prose, but the poetry really sort of kicks in. We're left with their poems in the end. That's what they're really working toward. There's a little bit we have from Alicia Ostreicher, and she writes in a poem, "To be blessed, said the dog, is to have a pinch of God inside you, and all the other dogs can smell it." So, you know, it's kind of funny. You know, the poet puts the arguments out there in a completely different way, you know, in the form of an image or wit. And as Jane Hirschfield says, kind of from her Zen viewpoint, think assailable thoughts or be lonely.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, Kazem El Lee addresses this to some extent in his piece. And he says, I suppose there's a connection between the multiplicity I find in the religious traditions and my writing. Everything can be two or three things, and I often find myself doubled back, writing lines in a poem that can switch meanings by the end, or writing a second poem that goes against the meaning of the first one, or writing a poem that answers an earlier one. I'm drawn to the idea of plural thought and multiplicity. Many of the poets that we spoke with for this book talked about this multiplicity of views when they talked about faith. There's not one truth or one simple truth. They talked about multiple truths, and some of which may appear to be contradictory, and how faith has to do with holding these views at the same time.
Yeah, he also has that wonderful phrase, which we put on the back of the magazine. I found myself thinking about it for days, and it seemed a little clarifying reproach to my own tendency to think about these things. He says, if you talk all the time about something, you stop knowing anything about it. Which is...
It's an occupational answer.
It's exactly true. I mean, the great paradox of these questions is that the minute that you think you know what you're talking about, you don't. It's so elusive, it goes right out of your grasp, and which is why the poems are better at getting at the essence than the prose, usually.
Kazem Ali says that this is true of poetry as well, that if he thinks too much about poetry or talks too much about poetry, he doesn't know what he's talking about anymore.
Yes, we know that.
Oh, exactly. On that note, Don and I should probably stop talking.
I know, that's
right.
Why I stopped in my tracks right there.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been great to talk about this book, and best of luck to you and Ilya with it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for featuring it. We really appreciate it.
A God in the House, Poets Talk About Faith, edited by Catherine Toller and Ilya Kaminsky, will be released at the end of March. You can read selections from the book and everything else that you heard on this program in the February issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.